This is number 0036, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0036. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File, Dan Calla is a Vancouver ER physician, a best-selling mystery thriller writer, and my favorite author. His new book is a bit of a departure. It's called Of Flesh and Blood. This one's a sweeping epic saga. Why the change of genre?
Nobody's done one of those industry-style books that Arthur Haley used to do, you know, Airport and Hotel. And I loved those books growing up. It occurred to me, you know, I've spent my whole life working in a hospital, absorbing the politics and the crises and the family setting that hospitals are. I'm in pretty good shape to relate a story of a hospital. I started reading up about famous hospitals, and one of them I read up about was the Mayo Clinic, which was started by a father and two sons who were all doctors in sort of Nowheresville, Minnesota, which became Rochester because of the Mayo Clinic. And I thought, what a great setting for a story to take a multi-generational family that's run a hospital and raised it to something that's renowned and kind of famous, and tell the story of the, you know, the current day hospital, and go back and tell the story of its founding and how the two stories are interrelated.
Mark Knutson is the creator of Aquanotes, a pad that you can write on in the shower. Why do some of our best ideas come in the shower?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different theories on that have been put forward. And, you know, I've heard everything from the fact that water creates kind of a white noise. I've heard that because of the water falling in the shower, it creates negative ions. I'm not sure there's any scientific reason that you can really pinpoint, but we do know that, you know, the shower is one of the best locations, you know, to come up with creative ideas, to have eureka moments, you know, overall. Promote creativity.
You'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
You know, I gotta tell you, CNN has the most stupid names of any TV shows that you'll find anywhere on the tube these days. Now, I know it's gonna be hard to find CNN because you have to look for it. Not too many people are watching these days, but use your GPS to find it. Hi, this is Steve Walsh. You know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're gonna want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest later is Carl Blair, a 40-year radio veteran who now runs the online radio service KDXRadio.com, which as of last week features the Stuff File program at 10 a.m. Central on Sunday mornings. In addition to a myriad of shows you can listen to there, be sure to check out Carl's program, which is called Blair on Air. You can go to the website at kdxradio.com and check out the schedule for his show and all the others. And thank you very much, Carl, for doing the slate on this week's program. And thanks for adding the Stuff File to your list of shows. Hope we live up to the quality of programs that one can find on kdxradio.com. And again, thank you very much, Carl. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, we start off with a story from across the pond in the UK. You know, one in five people in Britain thinks that haggis, the traditional Scottish dish made from the lung, liver, and heart of a sheep, is an animal that roams the Highlands, according to a survey. Commissioned by an online takeout food service, the survey found that 18% of Britons believe that haggis is a hilltop-dwelling animal. Another 15% said it is a Scottish musical instrument, while 4% admitted to thinking it was a character from Harry Potter. The survey questioned 1,623 people across Britain to see how well they were acquainted with the traditional Scottish food. Even 14% of the 781 Scottish people polled said they didn't know what haggis was. And you know, I'm sure there are people out there who have eaten the stuff who probably still don't think it's food. Anyway, let's move on to women with anger management issues. We start off with a lady in Australia. An Australian woman who ran down and killed a man who threw cheese-flavored snacks at her car was jailed for 25 years. Wow. Talk about lactose intolerant. Sydney woman Sarah May Ward intended to injure Eli Westlake for throwing cheese balls at her car. Judge Roderick Howie, in describing the 21-year-old's murder in New South Wales Supreme Court, said it was a senseless act of anger. She clearly wanted to teach the young man a lesson, Judge Howie said, as he sentenced Ward to jail for a minimum of 18 years. The jury was told that Ward, who was 39, had drunk two bottles of wine and used cannabis, amphetamine drugs, and antidepressants. Talk about hitting the trifecta. Before getting into her car in Sydney's northern suburbs on June 7, 2008, she decided impulsively to use the vehicle as a weapon after Westlake threw the snacks at her car as a joke while walking home with his brother and a group of friends. The judge said while there were more involved than Westlake's brother and friends claimed, an incensed Ward had driven directly at Westlake after a brief physical altercation with the group, running him over and killing him. Ward told the court that she had been scared of the group and hit the car's accelerator by mistake while trying to get away. Yeah, I'm not buying it either. On to Utah for our next angry woman. A Utah woman has been sentenced to 30 days at home with an ankle monitor for blindfolding her husband and promising him a surprise before hitting him in the head with a hammer. This took place 3 years ago, by the way. Amy Teresa Ricks also was sentenced to probation and community service in 3rd District Court. The 37-year-old pleaded guilty to second-degree felony aggravated assault in February. Prosecutors have agreed to reduce the conviction to a third-degree felony after Ricks completes probation. They also agreed to let Ricks seek expungement of the crime after 7 years. Ricks' husband suffered minor injuries in the May 2007 attack. At the time of her plea, Ricks' attorney said the two were still married but were separated. Okay, if you're separated and your estranged spouse asks to blindfold you because she wants to give you a surprise, well, that's almost worthy of being the idiot of the day. Almost. But really, what's wrong, pal? What were you thinking? Okay, let's head to the other side of the globe for our next story, shall we? Forget about getting a job as a police officer in Indonesia's Papua if you have had your penis enlarged. I'm not making this up. You won't get the job, according to a local media report citing the police chief. Here's a direct quote by the police chief, by the way. An applicant will be asked whether or not his vital organ has been enlarged. If he has had it enlarged, he will be considered unfit to join the force or the military. Unquote. The ban was applied since the unnatural size causes hindrance during training, said a police spokesperson. Makes you wonder how often this has come up to force the department to issue a directive. Anyway, Indonesia's remote easternmost province is home to Papuan tribes, many of whom are known for wearing penis gourds. A low-level separatist insurgency has waged in the resources-rich part of Indonesia for decades, and there is a heavy police and military presence there. Papuans use a local technique to achieve the enlargement. According to a sexologist quoted by the local newspaper Jakarta Globe, by wrapping the penis with leaves from the gatal-gatal or itchy tree so that it swells up like it has been stung by a bee, the expert says. Boy, that can't be comfortable. That's all I'm saying. Moving right along, under the headline of What's That Smell? Police said that officers searching for a man wanted on methamphetamine charges found him hiding neck deep in a liquid manure pit at a northeastern Indiana farm. Noble County Sheriff's deputies thought they'd lost the man until an officer spotted him in the tank beneath an outbuilding floor on a farm near Albion. Chief Deputy Doug Harp said the man, age 52, had been neck-deep in the combination of hog and dog feces for at least an hour. Wow. He later became combative and had to be shocked twice with a stun gun. The suspect was treated at a hospital for hypothermia before he was taken to jail. Gee, only hypothermia? Well, the Steuben County magistrates ordered the suspect held without bail because he missed court hearings in February and March. Please tell me they gave him a bath at some point. And while we're still talking about stinky people, on to Bellingham, Washington. Police said a Cost Cutter store employee was punched in the mouth after he confronted a customer about his body odor. Police spokesman Mark Young told the Bellingham Herald that police went to the store after a report of a fight and found employees holding down a man. The newspaper said customers apparently complained while the man was in the store on Sunday, and the employee decided to discuss it with him when he returned the next day. Young said the store employee was not going to ask him to leave the store, but only approached him to share the complaints. Young said the man snapped and threw a bunch of batteries and punched the worker, causing a minor injury. Wow, stinky disposition to go along with his body odor, I guess. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File with me, Peter Anthony Holder, you know, when I was in school, if I misbehaved, usually detention was enough. Believe me, I had my share of detentions. Sadly, today, that doesn't go far enough for some teachers. Two cases in point. Schoolteacher Lucia Carrico, who has been in good standing at the Hawkins County, Tennessee school since 1973, was fired in March over an incident in which she stabbed a seventh grade student in the arm seven times with a pen because she said he had been unruly, singing, and passing gas. Meanwhile, teacher Randolph Ford was fired in January by the Clayton County, Georgia school board for an October incident in which he allegedly put a hit on an 11th grade student, offering someone $50 to do him in. $50. Wow, to serve with love indeed. Or maybe goodbye, Mr. Chips. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? On with us right now is Dr. Dan Kalla. He's an emergency room physician in Vancouver, but the world also knows him as a medical thriller novelist, having written such books as Pandemic, Blood Lies, and Cold Plague. His latest book, though based in the medical profession, takes the reader in a different direction. This book is a sweeping saga that deals with the families behind a legendary hospital. The book is called Of Flesh and Blood, and Dan Kalla joins us right now via Skype-to-Skype technology from Vancouver. Hi, Dan. Nice to have you back on the show with us again.
Oh, it's great to be back, Peter. I love our interview.
Now, this new book, as I said, is a departure from what you've done in the past. You've written five novels in the past, all medical thrillers. This one, as I said, a sweeping saga. Why the change?
Well, you know, it's funny. Even though it's been a long time in the process, the idea was kind of spontaneous. My agent and I were talking about next projects after I finished my last novel. And, you know, he said, you know, nobody's done one of those industry-style books that Arthur Haley used to do, you know, Airport and Hotel. Nobody's taken, it seemed to be his term was the whole genre has lain fallow for several decades. And I loved those books growing up. And it occurred to me, you know, I've spent my whole life working in a hospital, absorbing the politics and the crises and the family setting that hospitals are. I'm in pretty good shape to relate a story of a hospital, you know. And once I had that idea, the whole idea to have a multi-generational, you know, like I started reading up about famous hospitals, and one of them I read up about was the Mayo Clinic, and which was started by a father and two sons who were all doctors in sort of Nowheresville, Minnesota, which became Rochester because of the Mayo Clinic. And I thought, what a great idea, you know, what a great setting for a story to take a multi-generational family that's run a hospital and raised it to something that's renowned and kind of famous, and tell the story of the, you know, the current day hospital, and go back and tell the story of its founding and how the two stories are interrelated.
But not only are you well equipped because you're a doctor and have worked in the medical profession to write a story like this, but aren't you also a multi-generational doctor yourself?
That's a good point. I'm a third generation. You go to my family reunions, it's a joke. Everybody is a doctor. It's the only one who's at all interesting to anybody is my brother, the mortgage broker, right, who's like the rock star of the family. Cause the rest of us, I knew exactly what it was like to grow up in a medical family before I had any idea what it meant to be a doctor. But I knew what the lifestyle was all about. And, you know, I don't think people realize that. When you're a doctor, it's a little like, well, it's a little like being in the media or a priest, or you carry, there's a certain stigma about you. And, you know, when you run into your patients at the grocery stores, you know, it's a bit different. And I tried to give a sense of that, how patients and problems at work can really impact the personal and family lives of doctors.
Now, both of your parents were doctors, right?
That's true, yeah.
Are they still around?
Yeah, they are. My mom just stopped working about 6 months ago. At 75, she was still doing family practice locums. It was only after her knee surgery that she finally stopped. But yeah.
So when your parents got wind of this book of Flesh and Blood and the story behind it, did either one of them raise an eyebrow?
Yeah. Well, they tried to get an injunction, a legal injunction against me writing it. No, they didn't. I think the idea intrigued them too. You know, they're fully aware of just how tightly linked a medical family we are. It's our family business. And so I think that idea actually intrigued them, you know, and certainly they liked the book when they read it. It's not really at all based on my family. I mean, none of the kind of doctor, I didn't use the same kind of specialist we are. I don't think I used any of the same kind of crises that we've gone through in our family. But, you know, I think I know the essence of that medical family.
So you've had 5 previous books, bestsellers, so now you're known as a best-selling author. But let's go back a little further before that. When you first started writing, coming from a family of doctors, was there any raised eyebrows there? It's like, wait a minute, what are you doing?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think people were, you know, my family was very supportive. I don't know that they believed, especially after reading the earlier stuff, that I would actually get published and make another career out of it. But, certainly it was, there aren't any writers in my family at all. And it was something I knew nothing about, you know, unfortunately. A lot of, you know, aspiring writers ask me about, you know, getting published, getting agents and stuff. And the only reason I did was because I knew nothing. I would have never persevered. I would have never stuck with it if I knew how tough it is and how tightly the odds are stacked against you. But so in that case, ignorance was quite helpful to my second career.
Was there ever a choice in your life growing up? Were you just going to be a doctor?
Yeah, kind of, sort of that. Obviously, you have choices. And as I said, I have a brother who ended up as a very successful businessman. And my other brother is a doctor, too. But yeah, it was kind of, you know, a bit of a default. My parents really didn't encourage me to go into medicine. They thought, you know, they thought computers were on the rise and engineering. And so it wasn't like anybody was pressuring me, but I did kind of fall into it. I must admit, it didn't involve a lot of thought and soul searching to end up applying for medical school and going through with it.
So tell us a little bit about some of the characters and the families behind Of Flesh and Blood.
Yeah, it's this one family, the McGrath family, that is the medical family behind it. And on the other side of the equation is this, the Alfredson. The hospital is called the Alfredson because that's the original lumber baron who endowed the money to build the hospital. And their family has stayed involved as sort of running the board of directors. So there's one family who owns the hospital effectively and one family that runs the hospital. And they've been in conflict for 100 years. And it goes back, the original pioneer was a young surgeon who came up from California to the Pacific Northwest with a dream of building like an altruistic and cutting-edge clinic where science could be practiced. Back in the turn of the 19th century, there was a lot of great medical developments coming up, but there were also a lot of charlatans and a lot of it was hocus-pocus. And so he strove to get this clinic built, and he found this financier because he saved his daughter's life with an emergency appendectomy. But he made an enemy for life of this financier because he fell in love with the same patient, and he was already married, although his wife was disabled, this young doctor. So there it started the hospital, even though it was a great hospital that fulfilled a very altruistic, especially for the state's mission. It was born out of a conflict that never died down. And 100 years later, this Alfredson family is considering selling off the land and the hospitals to a private organization. And meanwhile, the McGraths, they're going through their own crisis of their own. There's a heart surgeon. One of the sisters is a heart surgeon who was traumatized in Kenya and has lost her nerve to do heart transplants. She's suffering from post-traumatic syndrome. Another, the real, perhaps main protagonist, his name is Tyler McGrath, Aaron's brother, and he's a childhood cancer specialist who makes a decision on the patient that he holds, has the patient dies and the parents hold him responsible and he holds himself responsible. So he's going through sort of a moral crisis. And the father, William McGrath, has dedicated his entire life to this hospital, and he's trying to keep this hospital together as it's fighting superbug infections and the threat of sales. And so all these crises are brewing. You know, there's a bunch of intermingled storylines. And that's, yeah, that's about the characters I can remember offhand. Oh, there's two more. Yeah. My favorite character is this 90-year-old, very eccentric woman who keeps this. She's a granddaughter of the original owner of the hospital, and she keeps a collection of pornographic memorabilia out on display to shock guests who come through. And she's a very feisty little old woman. And her niece has come to pry, to sneak information off her great aunt. And they play this cat and mouse game through the entire story. And basically, the niece is trying to research the history of the hospital, but she has a very ulterior motive for finding this out. And meanwhile, the great aunt knows a lot more about the niece than she's letting on. So they play this game of cat and mouse, and it allows them to tell the history of the hospital, to put the 19th century story in perspective. But it also factors very much into the whole climax about the selling of the hospital and the resolution of how the hospital does or does not survive.
Having done the five previous books that you've done, all in the medical thriller genre, is this like a different, using different muscles to write this one?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, about a third of it is written at the turn of the 20th century. And that was, you know, to read up and get some historical facts right and not put electricities or telephones in where they hadn't been invented yet and all, and, you know, to get the language right and the nuances of social interaction. That was a real, but really fun challenge. It really whet my appetite for historical fiction. And, you know, the current day stuff, even though this is not a thriller novel, I still like to think I brought in the kind of, you know, the kind of technique and style I've learned from writing thrillers to make it a suspenseful novel without, you know, with still a few, there's one big twist in the story, and you know, I like to think I'd honed my skills of doing twists by writing mysteries and thrillers.
As a writer, do you still, even though you had such success with your previous books, do you still get nervous when a new book comes out?
Very nervous, yeah. More so than ever. You wonder if people have had enough, and, you know, you keep hearing bleak things about the book publishing world and book market, and, you know, so it's, that part is scary, the commercial aspect, but also the critical aspects. I don't want to let anybody down. I have people now who are pretty faithful readers, and I feel, you know, I have an obligation to keep the quality of my writing at the same level or even to improve. I like to think you improve if you keep doing something. So I'd be very nervous to see how it's received, and also, to be honest, to see how it sells.
Now, you come from a family of doctors. You're married to a doctor.
Yeah.
You're also a writer. You have two daughters.
That's correct.
Which direction are they heading, do you think?
Well, they're both very clear that they have no interest in medicine. My oldest daughter is trying to figure out which career pays best, and that's she's very driven with she's ambitious that way, but there's a bit of altruism there. Once she's made enough money, she's gonna make a corporation that helps animals, apparently. But until then, she needs to become the next Bill Gates. So she's always asking me what pays best. And my other daughter was just a performer. She's born to perform. If there's a light or a microphone near her, she wants to pursue it. And so I can see her ending up in something very artistic that way. But neither, I can't see medicine in either of their futures, to be honest.
Well, maybe down the road when your new book becomes another bestseller and is probably turned into either a movie or a television series, maybe your younger daughter could play a part.
I sure should like to make it a one-woman show, I promise.
The book is called Of Flesh and Blood. It's written by Dan Calla, and it's published by Forge, and it is now available. Sells in Canada for $31, U.S. price $25.99. I thank you very, very much, Dan, for being with us once again.
A pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
Dr. Dan Calla, author of Flesh and Blood. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the What's On page for this show, which is number 0036. And you'll find links to Dan's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
If you're into the paranormal, then you're into Don Ecker and Dark Matters.
Something I have been immersed in for 20 years. Lunar research on items known as lunar transient phenomena. For over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing strange sights, lights, flashes, and other things on the moon.
Provocative topics, listeners' calls, and interesting guests.
Guest Mr. Alan Stern.
On my website, I have a list of 100 or so lunar conspiracy theories. I had to kind of come to terms with one of them that I hadn't really thought about.
It's the kind of show that might keep you up at night.
Speculation is, at some time in our past, or perhaps even today, there is another presence on the moon. And I'm not talking about indigenous lunar folks. I'm talking about a space base by somebody else on the far side of the moon.
Dark Matters with Don Ecker, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the creator of Aqua Notes. Plus, we'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. And we have an idiot of the day. Plus, of course, lots and lots of stuff, including right here, right now. We go to Australia for our next story. In Cairns, a 51-year-old man was caught shoplifting in March, witnessed by security staff putting three limes and a package of beef tongue in his pants. When cornered, the man, like clowns exiting a clown car, pulled out an additional two onions, three trays of rump steaks, and a packet of lamb four-quarter chops. Boy, there's a lot of room in his pants, which may or may not be a good thing. I don't know. Meanwhile, let's talk about rednecks on parade. Itinerant contractor Billy Bobby Harrison, age 24, was charged in Spartanburg, South Carolina, with indecent exposure in February after he approached a homeowner, lowered his pants, and offered to pave her driveway later if she would have sex with him. Does he get a lot of business that way? Meanwhile, in Hemingway, South Carolina, police, responding in March to shots fired at the BT Express gas station, apprehended James Scott after he and Jackie Dollard had finished cleaning a chicken. Witnesses said Scott and Dollard fought over who got to keep the chicken. There's an old joke in there somewhere, but I'm just not going there. Let's move on to Amsterdam, shall we? It would make a good gag for a comedy if it weren't actually true. Thieves have broken into a Dutch prison to steal the inmates' televisions. Now, twice in the last 6 weeks, burglars broke into a minimum security prison and stole TVs from cells while prisoners were on weekend furloughs. The prison in the town of Hoorn, which is about 42 kilometers northeast of Amsterdam, is for inmates near the end of their sentences. The facility is what the Dutch government calls a very modestly protected environment where prisoners transition back into society. They are typically allowed weekend leave, which is when the burglars decided to take advantage. The thefts happened on two separate weekends, about a month apart in March and April. The ministry spokesperson said it has still not been able to confirm how the burglars gained access. A spokeswoman for the public prosecutor's office in the region confirmed only that a break-in at the prison took place and had been reported to police and added that no arrests have yet been made. I don't know. Has anyone looked at those prisoners who were, you know, home for the weekend? Any of their TVs look familiar? I'm just asking, that's all. Okay, we've seen guys on eBay auction off advertising space on their foreheads, expectant mothers offering advertising space on their pregnant bellies, but Aaron Jameson of Springfield, Oregon may have them all beat. Aaron was diagnosed with colon cancer and told he has just a few months to live. So he's selling advertising space on his urn. No kidding. The poor man says he hopes to raise at least $800 to help his wife, Christian, pay for the cost of his cremation. One friend, restaurant owner Dustin Remington, has already paid $100 for an ad that Aaron plans to hand-paint on the urn himself. Okay, moving on to happier stories. Well, maybe not happier stories, but a happier place. Anyway, The folks at Disney have messed up this time. Natasha Narula had planned to treat her daughter, Drew, to a day at Disneyland Paris, and she thought it would be fun for them to dress up as princesses for the day. So she hand-sewed two beautiful gowns for them to wear, and off to Disneyland they went. And they got as far as the front entrance gate before they were told they would not be admitted because they looked too much like real Disney princesses. Natasha said she was left stunned and humiliated after being ordered to return to her hotel to change. She said she then spoke to a manager who was concerned children would think I work there and wanted to have their picture with me. Disneyland later confirmed it is a global policy banning adults from wearing fancy dresses to their theme parks, and a spokesman said, "No one over the age of 9 is allowed to enter our theme parks in fancy dress. It prevents confusion." I guess no one goes to Disneyland for their prom. Natasha has now written to Disneyland demanding an apology. Meanwhile, finally, in this section of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we go to England for our next story. A British man banned from driving for 4 years for drunkenly driving a battery-powered Barbie car admitted he acted like, quote, a twit. Paul Hutton, who was 40, said he found the toy car, designed for 3 to 5-year-olds, abandoned about a year ago, and he had been working on it at his Jaywick, England home for about a year with his 17-year-old son. Hutton said he had been drinking while working on the toy the day of his arrest and decided to take it for a spin. The police pulled up and asked if I was all right, Hutton said. I'd had a few drinks, but I felt fine. I hadn't spoken to anyone all day, then I found I couldn't talk. Hutton was sentenced to a 12-month conditional discharge. His driver's license was suspended for 3 years. The Barbie car, by the way, runs on a 12-volt battery and has a top speed of 4 miles an hour. Okay, now, that's not the brightest idea in the world, admittedly. And I've talked on this program time and time again about people who drive drunk, which is stupid. But come on. 3 years he can't drive a vehicle because he was driving a Barbie car? A Barbie car? Are you kidding me? Really? I don't know whose idea is dumber. His idea for having the Barbie car and driving it drunk? Or the judge for saying, yeah, let's take his license away for 3 years. Bad ideas all the way around. Anyway, let's get to some good ideas, which brings us to our next guest. Next time you get a brilliant idea in the shower, don't let it go down the drain. Aquanotes is a waterproof notepad that sticks onto the shower wall. It comes with a special pencil to write down any brainstorms you might have while scrubbing. Now, where did this brilliant idea come from? Well, on the line with us right now is shower thinker Mark Knutson, who came up with the product, which you can find at myaquanotes.com. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Peter. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So I often get brilliant ideas in the shower, and sometimes you think this, when this happens, you're the only one. And you're saying, obviously, that that's not the case. Why does it happen when you're in the shower?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different theories on that that have been put forward. And, you know, I've heard everything from the fact that water creates kind of a white noise. I've heard that because of the water falling in the shower, it creates negative ions. I'm not sure there's any scientific reason that you can really pinpoint, but we do know that, you know, the shower is one of the best locations, you know, to come up with creative ideas, to have eureka moments. And, you know, overall, just, you know, promote creativity.
So when you came up with this idea, did you think it was just something for yourself? Or did you say, I know people think in the shower, I've got to market this?
You know, it took me a couple of years. I used to yell out to my wife and ask her to write things down. When she got sick of that, I started to keep a notepad right on the edge of the bathtub. But the problem with that is your hands would be wet and the paper would become soggy and you'd either lose the ideas or, you know, the paper would be ruined. And so, you know, it dawned on me one day that I really needed to create a device and potentially it could turn into a business. But at first it was just for my own use. And I used a diver's slate in the beginning. And the problem with that was you would have to retranscribe all your notes. And after a short time, the slate became kind of muddy, and it was difficult to read your writing. So eventually, we came up with the idea of just a notepad. I mean, it was so simple, I can't believe somebody didn't come up with it sooner. But it took about 5 years to work through the design, and here we are today.
So 5 years later, you've done this. Now, before you did this, or even now during the fact that you've done this, what was your so-called day job?
I actually do strategic planning and performance evaluations and legislative analysis.
Okay, so a lot of critical thinking goes on in your day-to-day work.
Yes, and quite often a lot of the problems I would be facing in any particular given work week would be solved in the shower. And so for me, it was just natural to come up with a product that would help me record those ideas.
So you mentioned you mentioned it was a 5-year trek between the time that you came up with the idea and the time that you now marketed it with myaquanotes.com, which is the website it's available at. Did a lot of people say, "Oh, this is a great idea," or did they say, "Nice, but no, thank you"?
Yeah, you really fall into one of two groups. You're either a shower thinker or you're not. Some people get in; they want, they rinse down and they're out in 2 minutes. Other people, on the other hand, might spend 15 minutes in there, and that entire time they're thinking through things. But what we've found is that those that do think in the shower, we've got four types of customers, and they love the product. As a matter of fact, we get calls about once a week from people who want to redesign the product or want different things included in it. This morning I got a call from Maryland, and a woman who owns a house cleaning service was telling us that she has a customer who's got a teenage daughter who is a songwriter, and this daughter uses a pen on the shower wall that is very difficult to remove and literally writes over the entire wall. This creates problems between the mother and the daughter, and the cleaner doesn't like it either. And she's actually asking for a pad that would be much larger than what we offer, and we're actually working on a prototype for that now. We get that same request from software developers, but within that group, we really have we've got some whimsical users. They leave love notes for their spouses, or they might doodle in the shower. We had one mother who said she leaves messages for her teenage son so he remembers to wash behind his ears and not smell for his date. But then we've got practical users. We've got people that do their to-do list, maybe their grocery shopping list, or a honey-do list for their spouse. They write those out in the shower. Then we've got really a hardcore user, and these are the entrepreneurs, executives who are coming up with PowerPoint ideas or outlines for a presentation or just ideas and concepts that they come up with in the shower. And then last but not least, we have a kind of a corporate user. We're finding that a lot of the corporations are beginning to get into innovation programs. They're teaching their employees to become better designers and thinkers as to how their products improve, their services can improve. And in their overall program, our notepad serves as a tool, number one, as a practical tool. So they're encouraging their employees to write down ideas whenever they get them, wherever they get them. But it also reminds them that those ideas can come at different times, and if you don't write them down, you're going to lose them. And then they also give them away as corporate gifts because it's just kind of a unique product that no one else has.
Now, you came up with this design. Is it regular paper or not regular paper?
It starts out as a regular paper, and then there's a patented design and process that it goes through to make it waterproof, and it's completely non-toxic, totally environmentally friendly, and recyclable when you're done with it.
And do you need a special pen or pencil to write with this, or any regular writing implement will do?
Yeah, what we find is any pencil lead will work on the paper in the shower. You can also erase. We have a specially designed pencil that's made out of a cedar wood that goes through a certain process that keeps it from expanding and contracting in, you know, the high moisture, high temperature environment of a sheller. But, you know, you can use a regular pencil. It will crack over time, but they're cheap. A pen will not work in the shower. Just for some reason, pens will skip over water as it's writing. So, you know, you do need a pencil.
And how much does it cost?
The low price, Peter, of $6.99. We are working on retail packaging at this point. We're hoping to have it in stores within about 6 to 8 months. But we're taking it one step at a time. You know, we're a small startup company, and we'll be at that point, you know, sometime in the near future. But right now, they're only available online.
And for that $6.99, is that just the pad? Is there a special adhesive to attach it to the wall? Is there a brace to it? And what is the cost of refills?
Yeah, the nice thing about this product is it does not permanently attach. It's got two suction cups built into the pad that will suction cup to any smooth surface. So, you know, that comes with a pad. And then the pencil and a suction cup pencil holder are included, so that can also go on the shower wall or anywhere else, you know, a boat, where we'd like to put it. At this point in time, because there are only, it's a pad of paper, the design is very simple, and there's only two suction cups that come with it, we don't have a refill. Basically, you know, the refill is the pad itself because there's no extraneous, you know, apparatus that goes along with it.
Well, great ideas often do come in the shower, and you certainly have come up with a great one. People can check out the website for Aquanotes, which is www.myaquanotes.com. I thank you very, very much, Mark, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the time to discuss the product and have a conversation about it.
Mark Knutson, creator of Aquanotes. You can purchase them directly from their website at myaquanotes.com. You're listening to The Stuff File with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve-a-rino?
Peter, I have to tell you, things are starting to come together. I believe it. I believe that I will be working full-time again, not part-time, not on a contract basis, not on a freelance basis, full-time in no time at all. I just have an inkling.
Ooh, pray tell, do we know for who, or do you don't want to say anything right now?
I don't. I've got like three or four irons and three or four fires, and somebody actually approached me and said, would you like to work for me? So that's a pretty good one.
Isn't that wonderful?
That really is, yes.
Yes.
So I just have to decide whether it's something that can happen or not under, you know, which I won't go into the details right now, but we'll see what happens.
Well, more on that in the future. In the meantime, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, we're going to do a lot of Missouri stories tonight because I'm at home and I kind of feel that this is a Missouri kind of day.
Okay.
All right. Dateline, St. Louis, Missouri.
And as you mentioned, it is your home state and it's a show me state.
It sure as heck is. I live here, as you mentioned. And, you know, Peter, as Americans prepared to file and pay their taxes, this was the 15th of April, it came to light that Democratic Congressman Russ Carnahan could be skimping on his taxes. The congressman apparently avoids paying Missouri personal property taxes on his 42-foot yacht. Now, we pay here on our cars, we pay a tax. It's not a lot. I pay about $150 a year or whatever on my car. A yacht, I guess, would probably cost $300, $400 a year because it's more expensive than my car. But anyway, he lives in St. Louis. He docks it across the Mississippi River in Alton, Illinois, instead of in his hometown. Illinois does not have a statewide property tax. Property is taxed at the local level only and includes only real property, such as land, buildings, or permanent facilities in Illinois. Here it includes cars and other stuff. Just a few hours earlier, the congressman gave a speech on the importance of all Americans paying their taxes that they owe for the common good. Yet another case of do as I say and not as I do, apparently.
Yes,
those people drive me up a tree. All right, we did mention Illinois, so for this next one, Peter, great line, Chicago, Illinois.
That would be the land of Lincoln.
Sure would. Peter, a dead man was elected mayor of a small Tennessee town, eager to oust a woman who had been appointed to the job after the previous mayor had died.
Well, wait a minute. Speaking of dead people being elected... And speaking of the name Carnahan, wasn't there someone in your state not too long ago
who was elected? 2000, yes. Yeah. The governor, Mel Carnahan, died in the plane crash and during a Senate race against John Ashcroft.
Right.
Who was the incumbent senator and went on to become Attorney General of the U.S. Mel Carnahan died in a plane crash about 3 weeks before the election. He was elected.
Now, is the Carnahan you mentioned in the last story any relation to that to the dead Carnahan?
That is his son.
Ah, okay.
Yes, Russ Carnahan, which brings up an old story about, oh gosh, it's Mike Shannon, one of the Cardinals broadcasters. I told this story before, and it always bears repeating. Russ Carnahan was visiting in the press box one time, and our good friend Mike Shannon says to him, "So, how's your dad these days?"
Yeah. Well, you know, now with the Carnahan, we have covered death and taxes.
Wow, isn't that great?
Yes. Anyway, I interrupted you. We had a dead guy in Chicago?
Yes. This woman had been appointed when the previous mayor died. Anyway, Carl Robin Geary Sr., who's a local alderman known for straight talk and always wearing overalls, was a candidate for mayor when he died of a heart attack back on March 10th. He defeated incumbent Barbara Brock 268 votes to 85 in the town of Tracy. This is a small city, of course. Anyway, election officials said the seat would be declared vacant and the city's four aldermen would select a new mayor. When asked how she felt about losing to a dead man, Brock said, "I'll live." She took that well, I'd say.
I think so.
Okay, let's move on. Dateline, Fairfax County, Virginia.
Oh, that's the Old Dominion.
Yeah, you do that too well, okay? I used to live there, you know. It's my old stomping grounds.
I remember.
I love Virginia. Anyway, next time you're going to the dentist and you find his office doors behind a refrigerator in a church basement, you might want to think twice. Police in Fairfax County have arrested 48-year-old Amparo Rodriguez and 54-year-old Oscar F. Moran for running an unlicensed dental practice after a patient reported them. The woman, who developed an infection after Rodriguez performed a root canal, led officers to the Falls Church area where they found a door leading to a basement office hidden behind a refrigerator. Rodriguez's lawyer said his client was in fact a licensed dentist, but not in the U.S., in Colombia, before coming to the United States. Apparently, sometimes licenses for professions, they just don't transfer too well.
Apparently.
Yeah, apparently not. All right, let's continue here. All right. Dateline, Marshall, Missouri.
Still a show-me state.
It still is. Missouri, like most places, is going through some tough times, but we're getting some help from the lottery. An employee of a central Missouri convenience store appears to be the winner of the biggest lottery jackpot in state history. The general manager of the Break Time convenience store chain in Marshall, where the winning $258.5 million ticket was sold, was doing a phone interview with the Associated Press when an employee came in and said he had the winning ticket. The state, by the way, is going to see an automatic $7.5 million going into its coffers. All this thanks to Powerball! And some people say nothing good comes from lotteries and gambling. Well, this is going to help pay welfare for somebody who chooses not to work.
Yes.
Let us continue with another Missouri story, if I may, because I'm doing Missouri stuff tonight, Peter.
Okay.
Okay, Dateline, Springfield, Missouri.
Still a show me state.
I still live here, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, be careful what you offer on Craigslist. It's true. A woman in Springfield needed to get rid of a bunch of household stuff fast, so she posted an ad on Craigslist stating that anything sitting in her yard or in her garage was free for the taking. Well, tons of people showed up to raid her goods, including stuff she didn't want to give away. People broke into her house and even took her dishwasher and her stove.
Wow, that must make her mad. I know I'd be angry if I put an ad in.
I would be angry too. And you know what I do when I get angry? I don't throw things at people. I don't yell at people. You know what I do, Peter?
I get an idea.
I take keyboard in hand and write a 2-minute tirade, and I have one right now, if I may.
A tirade away.
Thank you. It is time, as mentioned, for my 2-minute tirade, and this time I want to take on CNN. I know. Fewer and fewer people are watching CNN these days. That's the cable news network. Might I suggest it could have something to do with the ridiculous names given the shows on the original all-news network? Allow me to explain. Unlike the cable news leader Fox News and its aptly named programs that include The O'Reilly Factor with Bill O'Reilly and On the Record with Greta Van Susteren, CNN has the name of the host followed by something else that is totally irrelevant. For example, Anderson Cooper, 360. What the heck is a 360 there for? Why is that part of the name of the show? It makes no sense. Then we move to Fareed Zakaria, GPS. Why the GPS? Why is it there as part of the name of the show? Again, it makes no sense. Finally, there is John King, USA. John King, USA? What the heck is that all about? Why not, wait for it, the John King Show? There you go. It could be joined by the Anderson Cooper Show or the Anderson Cooper News Hour. Then we could also have the Fareed Zakaria Show, which would allow him to spew his views in which he could prove in his own pedantic way that he's much smarter than all of you dolts who bother to tune in. Of course, that would not take in too many of you because, according to the ratings, fewer and fewer of you are watching CNN these days. So, as I wrap up this piece, I'm going to borrow from a time-honored tradition in journalism, something you used to see at the end of every piece written by reporters, the number 30. That's right. Now, in addition to Anderson Cooper 360 and Fareed Zakaria GPS and John King USA, this essay is over. So, I'm Steve Walsh, 30.
Ah, yes, that from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
You're darn tootin'.
Yes, say those three magic words, sir.
Hit the theme!
This is the Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, but we have time for one more item, and that item would be the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
And we have to send a shout out here because today's idiot is actually one that was nominated by a listener. So hello to Bob Welsh, who listens to the Stuff File from St. Johnsbury, Vermont. And you know, this one is a toss-up between Idiot of the Day and making the Darwin Starter Kit file, but here goes. Police say a southwestern Ontario man was injured by shrapnel after a propane tank he was using for rifle target practice exploded. The man was from Shakespeare, Ontario, which is just east of Stratford. Police say two young men were shooting at the tank when a rifle shot found its mark. Good for him. Great aim. And caused an explosion. Pieces of the shrapnel flew back at the men, injuring one of them. He was taken to Stratford General Hospital and has since been treated for his injuries and released. So he's out among us again. Why would someone shoot at a propane tank? Well, there's one reason and one reason only. He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0036. Thanks for listening. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0036. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and twitter.com at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, streaming on PCJMedia.com, and over the air on World FM 88.5 FM in New Zealand. That's it for this show. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.